geeks and cinemaniacs. From the heart of Hollyweird, California, at the epicenter of all things eerie and awesome, it's time for Charles Band's Full Moon Freak Show.
This week, my special guest is none other than director, writer, producer, and podcaster Mick Garris. The man behind such genre faves as Critters 2, The Main Course, Psycho 4, The Beginning, and Nightmare Cinema, as well as the Stephen King classic Sleepwalkers and the epic TV adaptations of King's The Stand and The Shining. In 2005, he created the acclaimed Masters of Horror, an insanely ambitious TV series that amassed a staggering collection of talented directors like Stuart Gordon, Toby Hooper, and Dario Argento. Mick is a man of limitless talent and vision and a creator who has dedicated his life to strange cinema. Mick, welcome to The Freak Show.
Thank you.
Wow.
Great to be here, Charlie.
And what I've sort of read and introduced is really just a sliver of the work you've been doing over many decades.
Well, nothing. My resume is not as long as yours. But it crosses many years.
Yeah, I just got a lot of volume.
Volume. We sell volume here.
Well, you know, because that's one way to survive. But yeah. As you know, we don't really, there's no list of questions. We're just going to go with the flow here, which I love. But we have so much in common in so many weird ways. But let's start with the fact that I think you're the only person, certainly that I've interviewed, who was on the set of Star Wars.
I wasn't on the set, but my first job was answering phones for the original Star Wars.
Okay.
So my first job was as a receptionist, and I graduated to operating R2-D2 at personal appearances, including the Oscars that year.
No way.
The first and last time I ever went to the Oscars.
Wow. For real? The first and last time?
Yeah. And I was backstage in the green room with Betty Davis and Jack Nicholson and Olivia Newton-John. And saw Nicholson leering at Olivia Newton-John, who was wearing a diaphanous piece of clothing. And I said, do you like what you see? And he said, you bet.
Oh, yeah, God.
Very leeringly.
That is bizarre. So you actually operated R2-D2.
Did
that go
R2-D2.
Well? Did it go off on the wrong direction?
No, it was great. You know, I was in a tuxedo behind the curtain operating R2, who was presenting the sound editing award to Ben Burtt. And everything worked.
I saw that. Yeah. I remember that. Vaguely.
I'd never seen it because I was there. And then my brother, Donald, showed it to me like 7 or 8 years ago. So I'd never seen video of this. And it was like, I'm operating him there.
Wild. So my Star Wars story briefly is, you know, I started to make some movies, and I'm in my 20s, and a very close friend of mine, a fellow who sadly passed away, Gary Allen, was an amazing trailer editor, and he's a pal, and he goes, dude, you got to come over, and he's a pothead, and I'm not. I'm like sort of like teetotaler guy. Yeah. So you got to come check this out. I'm cutting this trailer for this awesome movie. So I go to the post-production facility, and he's working for a guy named James Nelson, who was one of the co-producers of the original Star Wars. And he shows me a trailer for Star Wars, the original trailer where the thing blows up or whatever it was. I'm going, wow, that is freaking awesome. And then he snuck around and he went into another room and he started showing me some reels because that's where they were editing the movie.
Yeah.
And I just like, you know, I knew this was going to be huge. So what I did, because I was finishing a movie back in the day called Laser Blast.
Oh, yeah. About I remember these little, it. Well, 3D. Yeah.
No, it wasn't 3D.
Oh, no, it wasn't. No.
Parasite years
that's
later.
Right. That's
but
right. But
what was cool about Laser Blast, it was my first foray into stop motion with Dave Allen, who I worked with for years.
The great Dave Allen. Because
these little alien guys, you know, carelessly leave a weapon in the desert. This guy finds it and blows stuff up. Then the alien guys come back and retrieve their weapon. So I saw Star Wars, and this is back when we had limited, very limited theatrical releases before video, nothing. We're the B-side of a double bill.
I saw Laser Blast at the World Theater, I think.
Well, there you go. Yeah. But I thought, oh, my God, Star Wars. So even though the movie was sort of finished, we finished shooting it, and I thought, I've got to have a scene when this kid goes on a rampage with his gun and blows crap up. I got to have a scene of him blowing up a big billboard of Star Wars. So it was after the fact, spent the extra money, got the faux billboard, went out to the desert, had my three-finger hairy guy, who's the pyro guy of that era, come, and we blew the shit out of the billboard, the faux billboard of Star Wars. That's my connection. But I did. I was fortunate to see. I wasn't at the Oscars or anything, but I was fortunate to see that footage. You know, on a Moviola, yeah. On a freaking Moviola.
Unbelievable! And that was 70mm film too.
Yes. Wow, really? Because what was I watching it on?
Maybe it was shot in 70, yeah.
I don't know, but I seem to remember Moviola. Maybe that was footage he got for the trailer.
Right.
I don't know. But anyway, so that was, I mean, that was in the beginning, but you were writing, you were, I mean, how did this all start for you? I know your connection with Spielberg and Amazing Stories, but I'm not a super Mick Garris film historian.
Well,
how did it all begin?
it really all started, I was doing genre writing for, I was interviewing people for various magazines and stuff, starting out with, in music, like people like Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin when I was a teenager.
Did you interview them?
I interviewed them, yeah, at the concerts when I was living in San Diego. And I was like, Cameron Crowe and I were both doing the same thing for the same publication, the San Diego Door.
Late 60s?
This was, 60. I graduated high school in 69, so I was doing it starting in 1969. Well, in high school, I interviewed Ray Bradbury and Rod Serling for my high school paper. So my interviewing bones go way back. But I started writing for the Z Channel magazine and then pitched them the idea of doing an interview show for the Z Channel called Fantasy Film Festival.
Okay.
And we had John Carpenter on. We had Steven Spielberg on. We had Toby Hooper on.
This is that era? Like late 60s?
No, this was now 79.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But my first job was answering phones for the Star Wars Corp. And then I was doing journalism, so I interviewed some of the people who worked on Star Wars and sold them to Cine Fantastique and some of the other genre magazines.
I liked that magazine. That was a cool magazine.
So then I kind of, after working for Charlie Lippincott at Star Wars, I started doing specialized publicity, genre publicity, where you know, I knew better than anybody what the magazines were and what the conventions were, which nobody'd ever done convention publicity until Charlie Lippincott took Star Wars to the San Diego Comic-Con.
Wow.
So I learned from Charlie, and I started working at Avco Embassy doing special publicity for The Fog, and they kept me on for The Howling and Scanners.
Did you work with Bob Ramey?
Bob Ramey brought me to Universal when he went there.
So you know that I made a movie that they picked up when Bob was at AFCO Embassy called Parasite in 3D with Demi Moore.
I was there.
And then you were there actually at AFCO? And then you must have been there at Universal because then he bought Metal Storm from me in 3D.
Well, I was at AFCO Embassy in 81 and then moved to Universal in 81, 82. Yeah.
So what were you doing at AFCO? Publicity or
specialized publicity where I did making ofs for all of those movies I mentioned.
Wow.
And, you know, I hired myself because I was cheaper than anyone else. And I was learning how to put pieces of images together to create a narrative that didn't exist before.
Right. Well, how were those making ofs used back then?
They were normally like an 8-minute video, and they'd be sent to news stations, local stations, and then it would use pieces of it. It was the predecessor to the EPK.
Right. And I was in the middle of that. Because in the late 80s, I started shooting behind the scenes on everything I made.
Yeah.
And then in 1990, when I did my deal with Paramount, I created this thing called The Video Zone, which was a 20-minute magazine that appeared on the VHS tape at the end after the movie.
I remember
that. And that was sort of definitely the precursor of DVD later and behind the scenes, because I just thought the fans would like to see more about how the movie was made. It was sort of my Stan Lee soapbox.
Yeah, but it was a very ambitious thing that it made it even more desirable to own these cassettes.
Correct. And the fans loved it, and many letters, and here years later people say, oh my God, I couldn't believe it. At the end of whatever, it's Puppet Master 2. You were talking about subspecies in Romania or whatever. But that's 10 years later. This is like 80, 81. So you're creating essentially those video magazines, but for the news stations.
Right. And there was one thing that I did while I was at Universal that has become kind of a perennial. You can find it all over the place, called Fear on Film, where Universal was putting out American Werewolf in London, Videodrome, and The Thing at the same time.
Wow.
I got those three directors on, And we did a round table, and you can find it. I have
a
page, mickgarrisinterviews.com, that has all the old stuff as well as more recent and making ofs.
So you sat with those directors on a round table.
And I knew them all at the time.
Well, because you were in that world. You knew everyone, it seems.
I'm kind of the Zelig of horror.
No, it's not true.
All the important people are up front in focus, and I'm the little out of focus guy in the corner of the picture.
Or working the D2 thing. Let's going back a little bit. So was your first sort of major gig the involvement with Spielberg and Amazing Stories? Because that predates Critters and other movies you directed, right?
Yeah, that was the break I had. I was doing the making of The Goonies, and I was up in Astoria, Oregon on the first day of shooting. And we're setting up to interview Spielberg.
Wow.
And so he's waiting and we're just chatting and he says, oh, you must do a lot of these things. And I said, well, I'm trying to concentrate more on being a writer. And he said, oh, I didn't know you were a writer. You know, we have this new series I'm creating called Amazing Stories.
Right, right.
And I said, yeah, I'd heard. And my agent has sent a spec script for them to look at. So while we were up there, there was a reader who had read this script, and I found out years later, I read the reader's report, and the last three words were, hire this man.
Oh, my God.
So Stephen knew me, and we got along well. And
this was all discovered during that period you were there?
That period, yeah. And so
talk about a fortuitous, perfect storm.
One ever says to somebody like Spielberg, yeah, I'm a screenwriter. I got a script in my back pocket that I think you'd love. But
people do say that, but you had the
They do, the but it's how to turn somebody off.
Right, this is true.
So it happened in a natural sense and was able to happen. And so he'd read the script and he felt the same thing. And so I was the first writer hired to adapt a story of his. He did 22 outlines for 22 episodes.
He actually did the outlines?
Yeah. And
wow,
so
I didn't know that.
I came in, met with them. They said, we'd like you to write one, and gave me the two pages that he had put together. And so I went home, and in 3 days, I wrote an episode. Turned it in.
These were 30-minute?
30-minute shows. He did a couple of one-hour specials.
I remember
Zemeckis
that,
did a one-hour that I wrote with Tom McLaughlin.
Wow. That's amazing. I didn't know any
of this. So I'd turned in the second one. They asked me the first one, they asked me to write a second. And a day and a half in, before I finished it, they called and asked me if I would be the story editor for the series. Now, I was on food stamps.
Wow.
I'd never made a living doing any of this stuff. Mm-hmm. I was working at Tower Records and in car washes and stuff.
I kind of recognize you from Tower Records, possibly.
I don't know.
I was there. There wasn't a weekend that I didn't go to Tower Records. I love going there.
Mostly I became night manager in Westwood. And
okay.
I did work sometimes in Hollywood.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's wild. Okay, so now suddenly you're making money. Somebody.
I went from food stamps to getting $100,000 a year to be
the story editor
on Amazing Stories. And then if I wrote episodes, there was money on top
of that. So when you got your first chunk of dough, what did you do that was foolish?
Nothing.
Really?
Nothing?
You didn't like go buy something crazy?
No. I didn't care about big fancy cars.
Right.
You know, I've never done drugs. I've never had alcohol.
Good
didn't
for
do
you.
Any of that stuff.
Well, I do have a drink, but I've never done drugs, so we can do one of these.
Boom.
Fuck that. Anyway, back to
making
money, story editor.
So what I did was buy a house, and I'm still in that house.
Oh, my goodness.
Almost 40 years later, yeah.
Good for you.
Yeah,
good
got married. And am still married to the same woman after 40
years. Wow, you're like a Hollywood anomaly here.
That's
like
for sure.
Definitely.
That's
unique.
Because, like you, we're not really Hollywood people.
No, true. And I could go off on my own thing, but I definitely have been in this bubble since I started making movies. I'm aware of other filmmakers, especially ones who I admire, like yourself, because because you dabble in everything, and you're kind of an awesome dude. And of course, my brothers work for you.
Wow, he's a genius.
He's
a musical genius.
He should be doing so much more. He's just one of those hidden gems that people should go God, Richard Band's music is ridiculous. I mean, it's so tied to all of our more well-known movies. You know, if you think of movies like Puppet Master or Reanimated, that those themes are just ingrained in those movies. But no, for me, I for better or for worse, I've done my thing in my own little bubble. And luckily, horror has always been not ever out of favor. And now, of course, you know, but I don't even make horror movies. I make fantasy, weird movies. I've never made a slasher movie. I'm not into the blood and guts thing. No. So I think the only one film I've made that is close to something that could be kind of repulsive if you're afraid of blood and guts and horror is Castle Freak. That's definitely a...
That's intense.
That's an intense Stuart Gordon movie. Otherwise,
but
my
it's
movie,
a Stuart Gordon movie.
It is.
You know, so it's elevated beyond the level. And I hate the term elevated horror. I don't believe in it.
That's right.
But there are slasher movies, and then there are more sophisticated and complex stories like the stories Stuart tells where all bets are off when it comes to violence.
Right.
But it's in the service of telling a story.
Right. And it's super character driven. It's not shock and boom. And so, you know, but anyway, we can, and I want to say, you know, to the fans of Stuart Gordon, I say this more often than not, you know, it's such a tragedy that he left us so early. He was such talented guy, such a sweet man. You would never, it's like a teddy bear. You would never, spending any time with Stuart, if you didn't know what his profession was, you would never think this like really sweet dude is like the maker of, you know, Pit in the Pendulum and Reanimator and From Beyond and Castle Freak and
Uncle Stuart.
Uncle Stuart.
Very avuncular guy.
Totally.
And I didn't know him that well when I hired him for Masters of Horror. So I didn't, I knew he had a sense of humor, but there was a part where someone's supposed to take an eye out of a cat.
Right.
And he said, well, let's just get a cat and do that.
Oh, Jesus.
And I, you know, a member of PETA. I've been vegan for years.
That's funny.
And I didn't know his droll sense of humor could go that dark. And I'm still slightly unsure as to whether he meant it.
And you should
not
remain unsure. So Stuart and I made a ton of movies starting with Reanimated.
Yeah.
But when we made, it was Castle Freak. There's a great shot in Castle Freak where the freak is locked up and hungry and they're not feeding him. And there's a cat that wanders into the room. And then the cat leaves. And just as it's leaving, we don't see it, but the Castle Freak grabs its tail and yanks the cat back in. And I will tell you, that was a real cat. The cat was happy later. We petted it.
But,
I mean,
but you didn't cut its eye.
No, we didn't. There's no eye cutting, and cats were always treated well. But no, Stuart, super talented guy.
Yeah, we had 126 cats in Sleepwalkers.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Who trained those cats? Those guys, those trainers are incredible. When
they were amazing. They were truly great. I mean, there are scenes. Well, in the opening scene, there's a bunch of cats outside of Charles and Mary's house.
Right.
They all had little harnesses on that were nailed into the lawn or on the roof or wherever.
Really?
But they'd been trained for it. So they were completely comfortable and they were mellow. And
because otherwise it'd be all over the lot.
Herding cats, which we had to.
So, okay, so amazing stories. You never directed one of those, right?
I did direct one. That's kind of what got me.
So tell us about that. You can tell I'm really super knowledgeable. But I know enough.
What interviews are for, to learn about each other.
Exactly.
So I was hired to write. I wrote or co-wrote 10 of them.
Mm-hmm.
And in the first season, you know, it was not a particularly successful show, but they'd committed to 2 years.
Wow.
Because
I remember that. Yeah, I remember that.
Anthology was really out of favor.
Right.
So but they had directors like Martin Scorsese and Clint Eastwood and Steven Spielberg and all these people.
Oh, I watched every show. Yeah.
Well, then you saw 10 that I wrote or co-wrote.
Okay.
So in season two, Steven said, I'd like you to direct one. In between, I had directed my first real job was an episode of the Disney Sunday movie that I wrote and directed called Fuzzbucket.
Okay,
and originally, it was a story I'd pitched to Steven for Amazing Stories that he passed on. So I made Fuzzbucket, and I'm going to open up very honestly here about this. But it was, you know, it was a great experience, and it was very successful for Disney. And it's on Disney Plus now, and people have nightmares from it. It's a kid's story.
Right.
But then Steven gave me the opportunity to direct the second one asked me to storyboard the whole thing. The second season of Amazing
Stories. Oh, okay, okay.
So I spent 2 hours with him going over the storyboards that I'd done, and he was really mm-hmm. excited about mm-hmm. it and said, you know, you're going to do a great job. And so we made it. And after I shot it, he said, you know, I just saw Fuzzbucket. And Mick, I'm not sure I would have given you an episode to direct if I had seen that.
Because
you know, it was very primitive. You know, I didn't know what a director did in those days. My first AD, I did almost everything he's supposed to do because he had the flu and was sitting in the corner for the whole shoot.
Wow.
So I was in way over my head.
Wow.
But I took it to heart mm-hmm. and really applied myself to learn about what lenses mean and what performance, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. how to help guide mm-hmm. a performance and make a unified whole. And it was a crash course, this half-hour episode.
What was it called?
Life on Death Row with Patrick Swayze, who was a convicted murderer who, during a prison breakout, is hit by lightning, and it turns out his touch can heal.
Okay.
Which
I remember
sort
that.
Of—
I remember that.
It's sort of
I saw
the Green Mile,
kind of,
which
you're right.
came later.
But this, but when Spielberg gave you that encouraging the little
oh,
speech, was that prior to you shooting?
Prior to shooting, yeah.
Wow.
Right before I started storyboarding.
Wow,
but he'd already committed and the script had been written and all that. But it was great. Mm-hmm. It's painful to tell mm-hmm. it, mm-hmm. but it was hugely useful. Mm-hmm. And maybe I would not have done as good a job had it not been for that.
For that, right.
So now that it's finished, I have a note from him on my wall in my office about what a great job I did and how wonderful it was. And
what a great story. I didn't know that. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So that started your – so now you're like, no, food stamps. You bought your house. I have to say, because just for fun, because I don't want to forget that interesting part of this whole – spiel so far. So what you did, and not having a taste for fancy cars, you took your money and you know what it was like to be on food stamps and you bought a house. You're still in the house. You're married. I did not do any of that. It's not like
bought a castle.
Well, that was later. But the first time I made money, I made money inventing a gift item business that then helped me make movies. But I made like a chunk of money in my early 20s. And I thought, okay, well, and then the advice was you should buy a house. And there was a house that probably today is a $5 million house that was available for $100,000. It would have taken $20,000 down payment. Wow. So I made a choice. Do I do that or do I buy a Lamborghini Miura? And I bought the Miura. Now the house, obviously, and then, I mean, whatever. And I quickly grew out of the fancy car thing, but it was, you know, I grew up in Italy, you know, so you got to have a Ferrari or a
Lamborghini.
Now the irony is just a few weeks ago, there was a big car show in Carmel, and that very same car, which I bought for $25,000, they're very rare, it's called a Lamborghini Miura SV, 1972, sold for $1.9 million.
Wow.
Now the house still would have been a better deal.
Yeah,
right? But I didn't have, you're very clever. You lived your life in a way that you focused, and I was sort of, for a while, kind of a wild person.
Well, it's different too, because I didn't get the opportunity from Stephen until I was 33.
Oh.
And I had a very blue-collar upbringing. We didn't have money. My parents split up when
I was
13.
23.
Yeah.
22.
So I I got a later start than most people.
I'm going to go with that. I was less mature because I was a kid.
No, that makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah. Okay.
But, you know, I'd never had anything.
Right.
And so it was, to this day, I still feel like it could all disappear any moment.
Well, I feel that way because it might.
Because it did.
It did disappear more than once. So I feel that way. And obviously, I'm living my life a little differently. But okay, so now I get all that. And then I remember going to the theater on Hollywood Boulevard in 1987, 88, and seeing Critters 2.
88.
There you go. So how did that, because that did really well, too. That was a big success.
It was a total flop.
The
Critters grossed like $10 million.
Once again, I just show you how much I'm completely.
But that's
Critters,
about that movie.
It kind of lumps together with Critters, which was
a big success on home video.
Of course.
But originally, the first Critters was a $2 million movie, and it grossed about $10 million, which made it very successful.
Okay. Who released it again? Was that New Line?
New Line, Bob Shea.
Okay.
So Bob Shea contacted me after I'd worked for Spielberg. Suddenly I was getting offers as a screenwriter.
Right.
And I did some screenwriting work like Fly 2 and Hocus Pocus, which I wrote 8 years before they shot it.
Wow.
But Bob Shea, Critters has a very Spielbergian feel.
It does.
And I think people felt like they wanted somebody who had rubbed shoulders with Steven and worked in
right.
that and had that sensibility and was a bargain because I was a writer-director, even
right,
though I'd only
right.
directed that one piece.
Right, right.
But they took a gamble on me. And it turned out really well, except for the box office.
That's the only
When he was on my podcast, he told me a story I'd never known.
Who's that?
Bob Shea.
Oh, you had Bob. Okay.
Yeah. So he came on the show and told me a story I'd never heard, that he had someone who was going to fund a huge, put a huge amount of money into New Line.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said, well, I've got a new movie opening. Mm-hmm. Let me take you to see it on Hollywood Boulevard. To see the movie and show you what we're doing. And they had dinner, and he was expecting there to be a line outside. There wasn't. They went inside, and there was nobody there, and he did not get the deal.
Well, there you go. Well, he sold to Warners eventually.
Yeah, 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 for a huge amount of money.
My history with Bob goes back literally to the late 70s, because
The origin story.
Briefly, you know, I started the first independent home video company in 77 called Meta Home Entertainment.
I remember.
Literally, I would, you know, people still didn't understand what it was. For a brief period of time, there was a lot of amazing movies available for no money because the distributors thought, well, this kid's offering me $5,000 for these video rights, and no one's going to spend $49.95 to buy The French Connection. How many
on Beta.
On Beta, well, and then VHS.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's another long story. But as that little label suddenly was becoming pretty successful, I really wanted Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and Bob had that movie. And I flew out to New York. This is the very abbreviated story. With money in hand, and we negotiated, and he said, look, the only way that I'm going to sell that movie is if you license all 180 of, like, the library, which
wow.
wasn't that much more than what I was willing to pay for Texas Chainsaw. And I mean, that's why, I mean, we had Pink Flamingos, so when I was
so
here a few
John
weeks ago
Waters
with John Waters,
connection.
We talked about that on Wizard or whatever. Anyway, we did the deal, you know, and we released Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which was a big hit,
had
even back in 1980 or whenever it was, back in the Stone Age days, on VHS. So yeah, Bob and I go back to those days. Then I lost track. And of course, I made Ghoulies shortly thereafter,
right.
which was the predecessor to Critters.
But, absolutely. But right. an antecedent from Gremlins.
Gremlins, right. That's right. So I'm in the middle of Gremlins and Critters.
Yeah. Well, I have nothing but good thoughts about Bob Shea.
Yeah, he was a
treated
great
me
Wheeler
great,
dealer. Yeah.
And
was
a very nice man. And I never had any intrusions or trouble. Every interaction with Bob was great.
I just remember the last time I talked to Bob, you can tell by the year, that was probably 30 years ago. I had made a movie called Prison with Viggo Mortensen and some others. And Rennie Harlan, it was his first movie he directed here. He did some stuff in offshore. Anyway, finished the movie. I'm not sure if it was even out yet, but I get a call out of the blue from Bob Shea. He goes, I'm thinking about hiring Rennie Harlan for Nightmare on Elm Street or one of those shows.
Number
And I,
four.
You know, what do you think? Well, and I gave him an honest sort of review, of which I'll save for another day. and he hired him. And then Rennie went on and, you know, made that movie and others.
It was a huge success.
Yeah. Critters, you know, many of my movies in the 80s, we had to release them theatrically. My deal, I had a huge deal with Vestron Video at the time.
Right.
So there was a P&A commitment for every movie. So every movie, P&A means you had to spend a certain amount of money releasing it in the theaters for prints and ads. And depending on the movie, it was substantial. That's why we had Empire at the time, had a theatrical distribution arm. We had three regional offices, because sometimes we'd go out with 1,000 prints.
Wow.
And never once in any of those movies, except for Ghoulies, did we ever make any money.
Really?
We didn't lose. The trick was not to – no one was making money as a little independent.
Right.
The trick was
– But that was the trailer for the video, basically.
Well, and it allowed us to get really big advances from Vestron during the time, because you had to spend $1 million to show them. Yes, as per contract, we have spent $1 million in prints and ads. You hope that most comes back, and it did. And based on that, you get a big final payment because you've promoted the movie and for VHS.
Got it. Yeah.
So that was the game for many, many years, and some did well, not never well, like making money. And one of the biggest losers was Reanimator. believe it or not. Again, these were all mega winners for Vestron Video. Huge winners on video, much like Critters, too.
Right.
But not theatrically. Because why? We first released it unrated. You can't run ads, so you know people weren't aware. And it was a bizarro movie. And then we thought, oh, crap, it's such a good movie. Let's cut it down a bit and get an R rating, which we did. And no one cared about the R rating. And people were saying, where's that great scene and all that stuff?
Right.
So by the time that was over, Vestron then released it on video. And it was a huge success on video. That was the 80s for independent filmmakers.
It was a great time. It was a great time, you know. Great and terrible. And, you know, every decade has its ups and downs. And
it does.
Has its personality.
I'm always wondering, what's next? Okay, streaming is here for a long time. I mean, you know, the internet's not going anywhere. Now, streaming will be different shapes and forms, you know, free, ad-supported, pay money, no ads. But we know, having been through this or living in this business now for decades, this will change as well.
Eventually.
And the question is, what is it going to evolve to?
Yeah, and by the time that happens, will we even care?
No, I care. I'll care.
No, of course you will. You have an empire.
No. I just have a bizarre, luckily unique library.
But you continually updating that library.
That's true. That is true. Yeah, that works because then, I mean, we just literally last week released our 13th The Puppet Master movie. So, after 32 years.
Yeah, I was going to say, what was the first year?
1990.
Wow, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, well, that's what we do.
And you're still kicking.
Yeah, I'm still.
The puppets are still kicking.
Kicking, super kicking, because I'm total denial, you know, about everything and anything.
Luckily, I haven't a clue what will come next. What do you think the next delivery system
I've been pretty good at predicting this over the years.
Starting with Mita,
those stories, I have so many funny video stories. People did not know what it was. Some people thought, literally, you bought the VHS and stuck it on top of your TV and it would play, not understanding that you needed a machine. I mean, I had more than one person, because we had a video store briefly as well, and that was not a good thing.
I bought my first Betamax in 77.
There you go. I've told the story. People go, no, don't tell the story again. But since I wanted the very first Betamax machine to hit the L.A. market, and I was literally Sears, it had to be Sears, the very first Betamax machines were in a big, huge carved Ben Cartwright console with a television. You couldn't buy the deck.
Oh, wow.
You had to go buy the big, ugly, carved piece of furniture with the TV, and it was built in there. And I did that just because I couldn't wait two more months to get the deck. It's like, no, I got to see how this thing works. Anyway, all right, so Critters, a theatrical bummer, didn't help Bob Shea at all. That's actually a good story.
But it did. It was a big success on home video, both
Well, that's,
and they did Critters 3 and 4 back-to-back for home direct video.
Well, we know how that went.
It's had a life way beyond what anybody anticipated, because it's one of the rare Easter movies around.
Right.
And it
right.
has that sensibility of Gremlins, where it's a lot of fun. There's violence, but
Absolutely.
It's also funny. And
kind of like Ghoulies.
Kind of like Ghoulies, yeah.
There's three of them all in a row.
Yeah. And but this, it comes back every Easter. There are theaters that play it, and I get called to go to festivals and things.
Well, I mean, because we're known for making movies with puppets and dolls and creatures and critters. That's kind of the Full Moon thing.
Yeah.
We have the exact similar experience, because the movies I've made during that era started probably with Ghoulies and then Dolls and all these films. People grew up watching these movies. They went to the local video store with their parents. They convinced their mom at age 7 to rent, you know, whatever it is. So it's a bit of nostalgia as well. And they do.
Absolutely.
They are somewhat timeless in a way, you know.
Yeah, they definitely are.
So do you have like at home some critter, like puppet doll? You got to have something at home.
I have not only one of the critter puppets, there's another one at Mopop in Seattle.
Okay.
I have Mother from Psycho 4 in a director's chair in my office.
What?
I have one of the topiary lions in front of my office, between my house and my office, from The Shining.
Really?
Yeah, this big puppeted, not one of the puppeted
ones. In the house you bought 40 years ago with your first dough.
And I've had that lion out there since 1997. So it's been refurbished several times.
Wow.
Yeah, just had it refurbished a month ago, and he's looking really good.
That is amazing. You know, you mentioned Psycho, Psycho 4, you directed that.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about working with Anthony Perkins.
It was challenging.
Yeah,
you
by
know,
then.
And I appreciated it at the time, appreciate it even more now, because he had directed Psycho 3.
Right, right.
He knew
right.
Norman Bates better than anybody, and he wanted to direct Psycho 4, but Universal said no because it was a critical and commercial flop.
Three.
Mm-hmm. So when Universal and a guy named Ned Nall, who handled their off-network
stuff. I remember.
Stuff,
was Raimi there at the time?
Raimi was there.
Okay.
Maybe he was. Well, this was 1990. So
no, he wasn't there.
He wasn't there by then, no. But they decided to do it for Showtime.
Right.
And then overseas theatrical. So he wanted to direct it, and they wouldn't let him. And so here's the guy who directed Critters 2. So I can imagine having a chip on your shoulder. You know, he's worked with William Wyler and Alfred Hitchcock and Orson Welles and all these
here's
people.
The guy
here's the guy who
too.
Did Critters 2. But I went out of my way to do the best job mm-hmm. possible mm-hmm. and to be as supportive as possible. But he would test me. You know, he would say, now, Mick, this knife, isn't that a bit hoary? Isn't that just kind of cliched? And we would have long discussions where he was testing me to make sure I wasn't some young hotshot just interested in the coolest shots possible.
Right, right, right.
But I had so much respect for the original. My executive producer was Hitch's first AD on the original Psycho,
no way.
Who also ran production at Universal, Hilton Green. Great man.
Wow.
And respect.
That was shot on the lot?
It was shot on the Orlando lot. It was the first movie shot there.
Because they built the same set.
Yeah, so they used all the same plans.
Yeah,
they shipped all the stuff. Mother's bed and everything was shipped from Hollywood.
My God. What an experience. Do you have any behind-the-scene material on that one? Anything that was shot?
I shot a bunch of home video. My brother was a PA on it, and he shot tons of stuff.
Have you ever shown that stuff to anybody?
Never.
You should put that together. I think that's great, fascinating.
I mean, it would be incredibly rare. Nobody's seen that stuff. Even me, I haven't looked at most of the stuff, but I've had it all transferred to disc.
Good for you.
Yeah.
Wow. So those... Yeah, I remember I've seen them all, and of course, the first one was just a mind blower.
Well,
especially when
absolutely.
I saw it, I was a little kid in Italy. I've told people say, "Don't tell the Italy story again," but I saw all these amazing movies growing up in Italian.
Wow!
So I had to rewatch them and then hear the original language because I mean I spent from age 5 to age 20 I grew up in Rome.
Yeah.
So and but they were very good there. The voice actors did an amazing job. But Anthony Perkins' voice was a deeper voice than he had.
Yeah, I bet.
That is higher pitch.
By the time I showed the movie to him, after having been tested a lot, we screened it for him in the Hitchcock Theater at Universal. And he could not have been more enthusiastic about it. He went on and on, literally 10 minutes, on how it was so much better than the one he made. And that
good for
all
you. It must have made you feel really good.
Well, I'm still brand new at this job.
Right,
and here's
this
icon telling me I did a really good job. But
we did a good job
together,
You had a rough beginning. You had Spielberg say, "Hey, if I saw that Disney movie, probably wouldn't have hired you." I mean, Jesus, that's a tough one to. But it makes you stronger, right?
Yeah, and at least he hired me as a writer.
Absolutely. All right, so now we segue. I mean, I'm sure the segue is many things, but. Your amazing sort of relationship and career with Stephen King.
Yeah.
I mean, come on, that's like, but in 100 years, when people look back, they probably won't remember Critters 2, but they go, oh, wow, Stephen King and those amazing adaptations. I saw, of course, The Shining, because I'm a huge Kubrick fan, so I was so curious to see what they would have done with.
Especially because King hated the Kubrick.
I know that whole story so well, which is. Unfortunate because amazing, brilliant writer, amazing, brilliant director, created in my opinion, one of the great horror movies of all time.
Absolutely. But you were there at the time. You saw that the reviews were all terrible when it came out.
I just know I went to the theater.
Yeah.
And I just thought, oh, the fucking great movie.
And you hadn't read the book first.
I had not read. I've read.
That makes a difference.
No, it does make a difference. I read almost all of King's books. Somehow I skipped that one, which I'm not unhappy about. I read it later to understand the difference. But I love his writing. I mean, I'm such a ridiculous fan. But a funny 2-second Stephen King story, who I'd love to say hi to one day. Yeah. Stephen, you are an awesome dude. Is I forget the name of the book. One of his early best-selling books. I'm reading it. And there's a reference in there to one, something like, in one of those Charles Band drive-in movies, I'm thinking, whoa.
You made it.
Yeah, I'm right on. I mean, I was
He named a character in one of his books from a Buick 8 after my wife, Cynthia. There's a Cynthia Garris.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. That's cool. I'm in there with Crash. I think that was the movie that he referenced, you know, one of those Charlie Band drive-in movies, Crash with cars or whatever.
I saw that at the Paramount.
Oh, I've seen it. Oh, you did?
Yep.
On the big screen?
Yep.
Yeah, literally shot that over like 3 weekends.
Wow.
On 35, cars blowing up, made a mess. I think if you read the book, I should mention the book more. I never do that. But my experience in making Crash was, you know, you needed the distributors back. This is the 70s. I was 26. If you're going to make a movie, make a car crash movie and put stars in it. Well, couldn't afford stars. Well, old stars, you know.
Right, right.
Guys who were for hot in the 40s.
Value.
Yeah, whatever. They wanted those names. And the names were, you know, impressive, even though they were older and wonderful to work with. But I bought 50 cars because that's the number I needed. And the criteria was a car that was on its last legs, that it could be bought for under $500.
No Lamborghinis.
At least, no, that was long gone. That at least would make it to the set. Okay, and like a total dummy, not knowing anything, I bought them all under my name. I just bought the car. Charlie Band now was on the pink slip. Then we destroyed everything. They got hauled away by 8,000 different methods and dumped. And then I started getting notices every year from twice a year from the DMV. Apparently, I was on the top of their most wanted list because, you know, unless you destroy a car and you do something, I even to this day forget what you have to do, it's in your name. I mean, thank God none of these cars went and killed someone because, you know, I would have some responsibility there. So it took me years to pay off all the fines because when you sell a car, you got to make sure your name's no longer attached. My name was attached to 50 cars.
Oh, anyway, and you can't just say they were all totaled.
No, they don't care. I mean, believe me. Anyway, that's a great place to take a break this week. But don't stray too far. We've only just scratched the surface of the life and times of our pal Mick Garris. Tune in next week for the final act of our epic chat. Remember to follow The Freak Show for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts from. And be sure to watch our video version of the show on Full Moon Features and Full Moon's Amazon Prime channel. See you dudes next time.